Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections here in the MSU libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted that you can be here tonight. The Michigan Writers Series is sponsored in part by Schuler Books, and we have a representative from Schuler Books sitting in the back who will be selling books by our author tonight. So if you'd like to pick up a book, please do go back and acquire it from Schuler Books. It's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Emeritus of English at Michigan State University, Jim McClintock, who will introduce our reader for this evening.
Good evening, everybody. Before I introduce Tom and welcome him back to Michigan State University, let me invite everyone who's here, if you wish, to a reception for Tom at my house after the reading tonight. A number of you do not know where I live, so I have brought along instructions. I hope there are enough of you. If you would like to come, please do that. I am delighted to be back here and to see Tom after quite a few years. I'm going to tell you how I first met Tom. I don't exactly remember how I first met Tom, but I do know that he kept showing up in my office over in Morrill Hall, and he wasn't a student of mine. And we would fall into talking about recent literature, and because I was teaching courses in contemporary American literature. But we would talk about writers that other people weren't reading and that weren't in the courses, and it was a lot of fun. Then he'd go away, and I'd forget about him, and then he'd just be there again another day. And the writers tended to be people like Jim Harrison and Richard Ford and Tom McGuane, all of whom have really written well and have been received well, and all of whom went to Michigan State University. So it was pretty clear to me when I found out that Tom liked to write as well as talk about literature that he was very interested in becoming someone like Jim Harrison and Richard Ford and Tom McGuane. Well, we had many conversations. And then that aside, I decided for other reasons in these conversations to give a doctoral seminar focusing upon the works by those writers, particularly because through the efforts of Peter Berg, among others here at the library, the Richard Ford papers are here. There are papers by Jim Harrison. There are papers by Tom McGuane. They were all over here. And I thought this would be a great chance for doctoral students to dive into them. Well, Tom showed up again in my office, and he had heard about the course, and he asked if he could sit in, even take it, I thought. And he was an undergraduate. And so I thought, why not? And he signed up for this doctoral course seminar focusing upon these writers. It was fun. He looks a little boyish now, but he looked a lot more boyish then. He is from Escanaba, and his persona was pretty much that of a curly-haired guy with a baseball cap, you know. And it was a good persona, and it worked well here. Anyway, he showed up in the doctoral seminar, and pretty soon we had papers to come in. And he showed up after a while with this paper about how the critics had savaged Harrison's work and Richard Ford's work and Tom McGuane's work. And I don't remember much about the paper other than that it was really good, except that it began with a quote from that great 18th century literary figure, Samuel Johnson, which was, "He's a critic, kill the dog." And so I knew that Tom had an eye for wit. Well, he did his papers in that seminar, and the other graduate students, wonderful people, I saw looking at each other, rolling their eyes, and eventually having a wonderful time because Tom was so good in a way that made them not hate him. A wonderful attribute. He graduated and joined the Peace Corps and went to Uzbekistan. And one thing led to another, and we have now this wonderful book, Chasing the Sea, Lost Among the Ghosts of Empire in Central Asia. It's a marvelous book, a breakthrough book for him. He's a fine writer. This shows it. I am very happy for him and for us. He's bringing us news from Uzbekistan. Now, that will be news indeed for a lot of us here. There may be someone here tonight from Uzbekistan. Yes. Welcome. Now, he can tell us, I'm sure, that Americans don't know about Uzbekistan. They have no idea where it is, has no idea what goes on there, and they will say, where is that or what is it? And maybe they don't even know it's a country. I don't know. There are many learned people in this room tonight, and some of them do know, but many of these learned people here do not know, I suppose. For those who have no idea right now, I can say that it shares a border with many countries, but one of those, well, a small border with Afghanistan, so it's just north of Afghanistan. Anyway, Tom is bringing us news from there because after he was in the Peace Corps for 7 months, he came back here and decided to go back for a lot of reasons. I don't know all of them. But one of them was because he took an interest in the Aral Sea and that great ecological disaster that's taking place there. The Aral Sea was as big as Lake Michigan. And it's partly about half in Uzbekistan and then partly goes north into Kazakhstan. For a number of years, it has been shrinking for a variety of reasons because of what humans have done. And it used to be a great and fecund fishery, for example. It no longer is. It's not a fishery any longer. It may just entirely disappear. This, of course, is not only a natural disaster, it's a human disaster. And Tom was attracted to telling others about it. The title of this book, Chasing the Sea, the main part of the title, I really refer to that because the Aral Sea receded so much that the main fishing city eventually became 40 miles away?
It's 100 miles away.
100 miles away. And at one point, it was getting quite a ways away for these fishermen, and so they desperately began digging canals so they could go out to work. And they dug canals. And they went out to work, and the canals had to get longer, and then finally they couldn't do it. They described this as chasing the sea. But the rest of the title of Tom's book is Lost Among the Ghosts of Empire in Central Asia. This book is not entirely about an ecological disaster. In fact, it is a lot about being lost, I suppose, in a way. Tom, you know, like most excellent travel writing, like all good travel writing, it's partly about the place, but it's also about the person who's experiencing the place, perceiving the place, who's there. And that was Tom. And his translator, a young man who became a very close friend, whose name was Rustam. Is that correct?
Rustam,
yeah. Who was part Uzbek and part Tajik. And the two of them did, in fact, sort of wander around Uzbekistan, having many adventures and misadventures. Well, Tom, I suppose, in a way, was an innocent abroad, but he was also perceptive, and he prepared himself with a lot of reading and a lot of thinking. And, of course, he loves language, and he writes wonderfully. He's going to be up here talking, and I'm not, so I'm going to stop pretty soon, but I wanted to, you'll know what he's like after you hear him a little bit. But just before I came over, I noticed that he's in the index. He didn't write the index. Somebody did. But I like this. I'm just going to try to define his character and how wonderful he is, smart and all that. But here it is. Sections under Tom Bissell. This is beside lots of things about architecture in the Islamic world and landscape and politics and so on. But under Tom Bissell has effects of food and drink on. I've read the book. They were serious effects in both cases. Another one. A little shorter section, number of things. Police encounters of. He was taken for a drug dealer at one point. He was taken as a Jehovah's Witness. He covered it all. A little shorter section, Tom Bissell and women. I read very carefully. He was an honorable man in Uzbekistan by his own account. Another, feelings of failure. Won't comment on that. And a long number of citations about himself as a writer. He is a writer and a very good writer. and I'm delighted to welcome Tom Bissell to read from Chasing the Sea.
Wow, thank you all very much for coming. You can hear me, I suspect. This wireless, I feel just like Britney Spears. That was a really fine introduction, Jim. I really thank you for that. But I do have to say, this person you described turning up your office over and over again sounds like a real asshole. As Jim mentioned, this book is partially about the Aral Sea disaster. That is the hook, as they say, for it. But it's also about a lot more. The Aral Sea disaster, which I'll try to explain quickly, because the section I'm going to be reading from this book does not concern the Aral Sea disaster. As Jim mentioned, the Aral Sea had the water volume of Lake Michigan. And in 1865, the American Civil War set any number of things into motion. But one of the things it set into motion was the fact that Tsarist Russia lost its cotton supply. So they realized they needed a large piece of land to grow lots of cotton on very quickly. They were already pushing south into Central Asia, an area we now call the Stans. And they realized that if they diverted the Aral Sea's tributaries and flooded the desert, well, that would be a splendid place to grow cotton. And they did that, and that's what they began to do. Now, of course, when Tsarist Russia fell to the Bolsheviks in 1917 and Soviet regime took over, that cotton growing grew a lot worse. By the 1950s, the Soviets, who are not noted for their respect for the natural world, sort of looked around at each other and said, well, gosh, imagine how much money we could make if we just don't care how much water we waste. We can drain the whole sea. Wouldn't that be fantastic? So that's what they set about doing. They diverted every single tributary to the Aral Sea, and they began a program of irrigation that is so reckless it has now led to today, what is today, while you and I are all sitting here alive, an ecological disaster without parallel in known human history. A lot of people who are not familiar with the Great Lakes, who are not familiar with something like Lake Michigan, have a hard time conceptualizing what a body of water that large vanishing in 40 years is like. Well, I don't think I need to explain that to anyone in this room. I think everyone understands that very clearly. Now, the added problems are that as the sea has disappeared, it's become clear that over those 40 years of reckless Soviet irrigation, they were dumping pesticide and DDT and toxic waste into the sea, which as it has receded, has left an exposed dust bed, which is poisonous. And which blows all over the place and has led to cancer rates that I can only say are jaw-dropping. They're never officially recorded because medical statistics are very hard to come by, but the cancer rates are horrific, and it's got the worst tuberculosis epidemic anywhere in the world. In fact, it's so bad that when I came back, I tested positive for tuberculosis. I never became symptomatic, but I'm a carrier of it, and just about everyone who goes out there comes back with positive TB test. So that's a little present from the Aral Sea disaster that everyone gets. So you can feel free to shake my hand later. No one will get TB, I promise. So why I was attracted, and to explain that little squeak my voice just did, I have a very bad cold, and it's probably appropriate considering the subject matter that I'm going to need a lot of water while I'm reading tonight. Why I was attracted to the Aral Sea disaster, I really don't know. But I can say that, Jim, I was a very serious writer in college, and I never, well, if you would have told me 7 years ago that I'd come back to my alma mater and read from my first book, I would have been delighted and surprised, but I probably would have believed you, if you'll allow me that vanity. If, however, you told me that I would be back in 7 years reading from my first book, and that my first book would have a camel on the cover of it, I would have found that a little harder to believe. I never intended to write what someone said to me recently is basically the first general audience book about the Aral Sea disaster. And that I have, I still find sort of strange. And a lot of people have asked me, why does the Aral Sea persist? Why does it keep getting worse? And why does no one do anything about it? And it's because most environmental stories are a warning. Most of them are a sort of wake-up call. Well, the RLC is dead. It's over. It's just going to keep getting worse, and there's really nothing anyone can do about it. Part of the reason is that these irrigation schemes the Soviets have set up are so elaborate that to try to restore these feeder rivers back into the Aral Sea would just wind up starving people and taking away their drinking water. So you can't really solve the problem without hurting many, many, many people upriver from the source rivers. So the Aral Sea has to be allowed to die. And what does that suggest? Well, as I say in the book, it suggests that human progress comes at the price of condemning obscure parts of the world to unimaginable suffering. And I'm not sure the RLC is unique in that, but I suspect that that's probably true. I also want to point out that industry, and I'm not certainly not anti-industry, and I hope this book doesn't come off that way, because industry is, of course, one of the cornerstones of the human experience. But what the RLC does suggest, and what I would like this book to try to suggest to readers, is that industry needs to be hemmed and watched and safeguarded and regulated as much as you possibly can. Because if you give industry an ecological inch, it will take an ecological light year, as the Aral Sea story suggests. Now, I have a theory as to why the Aral Sea disaster remains so unknown in this country and in various parts of the world. And I suspect it's because conservatives, despite how much they love stories that show the Soviet Union in a poor light, they don't like the Aral Sea disaster because it suggests that, you know, maybe business and government don't do such a good job of taking care of the environment if they're allowed to do their own thing. And liberals don't like the Aral Sea disaster story, despite how much they love environmental disaster stories, because they can't blame it on the United States. So so that's my primer on the Aral Sea disaster. Which I hope will give someone some mode of understanding what the book sort of drives to. Now, there are a lot of other tributaries in the book, too, I hope. One of them, as Jim mentioned, is this guy that I met named Rustam, who became a very dear friend and who I pal around Uzbekistan with. And he and I have various adventures and go to various cities and talk a lot. The entry for Rustam in the index is even more elaborate than my own, and I didn't write the index, and I debated whether or not to include that long, self-indulgent index mentioned of me, but now that you read it here tonight, and I saw I got a laugh, I'm not so mad anymore. But the section I'm going to read is Rustam and me in a city called Samarkand, which to me is just one of the grandest, most wonderful cities in the world. It was the capital of the world in the 1400s when a man we know as Tamerlane, or Tamburlaine, Christopher Marlowe wrote a very violent, bloody play about him, and Handel wrote an opera about him. The Uzbeks know him as Amir Timur, who was one of the most psychotic and bloodthirsty despots probably who ever walked the earth. But within that violent, despotic man was also an amazingly visionary patron of architecture and the arts. And what he created in Samarkand is really regarded as one of the most amazing sort of public works programs that ever lived. Now, most of those buildings have fallen down, or they've been restored so much that you can't really appreciate what these buildings are today. And a lot of the restoration was Soviet restoration. Soviet, you know, restoration is to restoration what, you know, military music is to music. So a lot of the buildings have for all practical intents, been destroyed. But you can look at their shells. You can look at these attempts to approximate what they were like. So we are in the city of Samarkand, and one of the things I've agreed to do is transfer money to the wife of an imprisoned Uzbek journalist whom I call Ahmad. Ahmad is in prison for making fun of Uzbekistan's president, a man named Islam Karimov. And the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is a very admirable organization I admire very much, asked me if I would mind bringing $2,000 to his wife. I instantly said, absolutely, I'd love to do that. And then when I'm going through customs and I realize I have $2,000 strapped to my body that I do not plan on declaring, and if it is found, I can basically kiss that $2,000 goodbye, because the custom agent will say, well, gosh, you didn't declare this. I think I'll just help myself to that. Since Uzbekistan is a wonderful but fairly corrupt country, it became rather nerve-wracking, and I had to get rid of this money. I had to give it to Omad's wife, who was suffering, and Omad was suffering as a man who was tortured, beaten, detained by agents of the Uzbek secret police. And I would like to say before I begin reading, Uzbekistan is one of our great allies in the war against terror. So Rustam and I are waking up after a night of revelry, and I'm thinking about the fact that I have to bring Omad's wife the $2,000, which is something Rustam does not want me to do, because for obvious reasons he's less than eager to involve himself with the security and intelligence apparatus of his country. The next day, Cosmonaut's Day, one of the few Soviet holidays still, if unofficially observed in Uzbekistan, every television channel featured the same basso profundo Russian narrator, exalting Soviet space exploration over slightly different documentary footage. Flame-sprayed launch pads, pods shedding their rockets at the sparkly shore of space, Russian cosmonauts' potato faces encased within helmet aquariums. Rustam settled on an engrossing feature exclusively concerned with Laika, the Soviet space collie, who, we learned, had perished within her space capsule upon atmospheric reentry. Poor Laika, Rustam said, experimenting with his hairdo in the mirror and singing offspring songs to himself. Pretty fly for a white guy, I believe, is what he was singing. Too bad for Laika. I was in bed. I could not move. The night before, we had gone drinking and dancing with several of Samarkand's Peace Corps volunteers at a nightclub called Shark. I remembered very little of this night. I remember doing shots of vodka, and I remember dancing spastically and alone to Tom Jones's Sex Bomb. I remembered standing too close to the dance floor vent that discharged the dry ice. I remembered Rustam splashing cold water in my face. Vodka was no beverage, I thought. It was memory-erasing headache fuel. It was now 10 in the morning. We had to check out by noon and by 6 be in Bukhara. Omad's wife lived in a village 15 miles out of the city, and I had to travel there and return in 2 hours, and I had to do this alone, as per my promise to Rustam that I would not involve him. After spending the next hour fretting about wasting time, I picked up the phone and dialed the number of Omad's wife. While it rang, I watched Rustam. He was still preening in the mirror, teasing up little cowlicks and with a sour look flattening them and starting over again. After 15 rings, a recording in Uzbek told me the number I was calling was not currently in service. I slammed the phone back on the receiver so roughly its inner bell held a long, sharp note. Rustam looked at me in the mirror. What's up, bro? He was an exchange student in California, which I should have said before. What's up, bro? The wife's phone is broken. With two gelled fingers, he sharpened the point of his black forelock. So don't go. He did not turn from the mirror. I have to go, Rustam. No, actually, you don't. Rustam escorted me outside and helped me book a cab, explaining to the driver that it was very important that he, the driver, wait for me while I conducted my business, then return me to this spot, exactly this spot. The driver agreed. Rustam asked me for the slip of paper on which Omad's wife's address was written. This he gave to the driver, a youngish Tajik man with wraparound sunglasses. He looked at the address and shook his head. This isn't an address. What? Rustam asked. This isn't an address. This is simply the middle of the village. But you know where the village is. He shrugged yes. Rustam looked at me, relaying what had just been said. What do you think? Do you sit comfortably with this situation? I did not sit at all comfortably with this situation. I remembered now, having been told by a committee to protect journalist representative, that some address confusion was a possibility. In that case, I was told, I might have to ask around the neighborhood a bit. Well, being briefed in CPJ's quiet Chelsea office in New York City, that had sounded excellent. Adventure. The hell with it, I told Rustam now. I'll see what happens. As I was getting into the car, Rustam grabbed my arm. Dude, I can go with you. Do you want me to go with you? I'll go with you. No, it's all right. Don't worry. Bro, I'm serious. You could get into a lot of trouble. I'm not going to get into any trouble. Everything's going to be fine. As we pulled away, I tried to get comfortable in the car. Its interior had, for some reason, been stripped. The backseat door handles had been removed, leaving neat square excisions filled with short sprays of thick clipped cable. Naked screws were all that survived the mid-door levers used to roll down the windows. As we drove, I slipped into and fought my way out of a series of short hangover naps, opening my drugged eyes every few minutes to see bright desert, roadside homes, bright desert, playing children, a checkpoint. I sat up. The checkpoint border guard and the driver were speaking Tajik. The guard nodded, looked at me through the dirty window, and waved us through. 10 minutes later, the driver pulled up alongside a small woebegone repair shop. One of its mechanics crouched shoeless outside the front door while fixing a wheelbarrow. In our wake rolled in a thick white cloud of dust, which enveloped him. When the dust cleared, the man shook his head at us. I looked around. This was less a village than a suburb. A few shops and houses, a tiny empty park and rusty playground, a government building, one could determine this by the air conditioners in the windows, all as loud as helicopters, some ugly Soviet-style apartment buildings, everything motionless beneath an uneasy pall of dusty sunshine. The driver handed me a special spanner fit with a special head. I used this tool to roll down the window, reached outside, and opened the vehicle's back door. I walked across the street to a dilapidated three-story apartment building surrounded by piles of garbage. Some of this garbage was moving. As I got closer, the moving garbage exploded, and dirty feral cats streaked across my path. But soon I walked past the cat's new hiding place, and this needlessly upsetting process began again. I crept around behind the apartment building, squeezed through two of its small, rusty, freestanding car garages, and stepped up a shattered flight of stairs into the building's rear foyer. The ground floor stank heavily of human feces. Finally, marbled through the smell were traces of cat urine, ash, and something like spoiled food. Again, I had a bitter thought at the Soviet experiment. Concocted to connect man to his work and designed to make inalienable the basic comforts of modern industrial life. Yet Soviet communism chipped and sanded at man until he was unable to do his work or any work, while the basic comforts of modern industrial life altered and updated far too quickly for its lumbering systematics. The only things the Soviet system did with any consistency were wreck and destroy. Now the experiment's subjects were abandoned in toppled ruins no one would ever repair, and the smell of shitty failure pressed in from all sides. Few long-term fates could be considered grimmer than life on the first floor of a Soviet apartment building, where filth of all kinds collected. What if this fate were my own? Would I too defecate in stairwells, join Islamist whip rounds, drink myself rotten every night? Would it ever occur to me to stand up to the government as Omad had and paid for? I did not think so, nor did I know what to do. If I knocked on a door and asked whomever answered if he or she knew Omad's wife, it seemed unlikely that he or she would feel comfortable answering. I had ruled out completely the possibility of her apartment falling under any concentrated surveillance. If she was being watched, it was by neighbors on the dole of the SN Bay, which is the forerunner to the KGB in Uzbekistan. Which meant alerting the village that a foreigner was looking for her was the worst option I had. I stood there in the reeking, humid dark, touching the $2,000 stuffed in my money belt. Unfortunately, it was the only option I had. An old ethnic Russian woman answered the first door I knocked on. She wore a tattered white shawl and smelled of moths, cats, small meals baked for one. She was murky-eyed, her wrinkled and trembly open mouth, unsure whether to smile or summon help. "Excuse me," I said in Russian. "Do you speak Uzbek?" "I don't speak Russian." I then spoke bad Uzbek. I now speak even worse Uzbek. "Excuse me," I said in Russian. "Do you speak Uzbek?" She closed the door. I walked upstairs and rang the first doorbell to present itself. It made a sound like chirping birds. Another old woman, an Uzbek as small and portly as a pigeon and wearing a green Uzbek house dress over billowy gray genie pants, opened the door and looked at me. We exchanged salams, the woman charily stepping back, her hand still on the door at the ready to close it. Quickly, I explained that I was an American looking for the mother of my friend who lived in this village. I had, I said, a gift for her. "I don't know her," she said. "I will tell you her name." "I don't know," she began to close the door. "Please, good mother, I need your help." The woman looked at me through the door's 6-inch crack. Upon her head, she wore a scarf decorated with red and yellow flowers. Beneath it, her homely face pinched and flexed. "What is her name?" I told her, and In her hesitation, I knew that she knew. She knew, at least, the name of the local woman whose well-known journalist husband had been dragged off and thrown into prison. I don't know her, she said. Which building does she live in? I don't know her. I understand. Which building? Three. This is one. Thank you, good mother. Very quietly, the door closed. Building three, which was across the street, was in no better condition than one. As I approached the building, a woman on the third floor poured a plastic washtub of hot, soapy water from her window to the hissing displeasure of several deluged cats. I stepped into the building's foyer and considered the shambles of its dented, doorless, ripped-apart personal mailboxes. None had names or numbers. I was not yet afraid. I became afraid when, while walking down Building 3's garbage-strewn second-story hallway and hoping to spontaneously develop extrasensory perception, a man opened his door and asked me who I was and what I was doing here. Trying to find my friend's mother, I said. The man was heavy, tan, and slovenly, with a head of flat black hair, large dirty hands, and a t-shirt that had been prodigiously stained by his armpits. Who are you? I'm an American. I'm looking for my friend's mother. I thought it over, then told him her name. He nodded. She's not here. She's gone. Behind him was the dead indoor light of drawn shades, squalor, the only identifiable object a television set at a low burning volume. Russian game shows, it sounded like. Thank you, big brother. Goodbye. He bid me in, his expression not changing. Come inside, my friend. Wait for her. To reach the stairs, I had to pass him. Thank you. Goodbye. He touched me as lightly as a ghost as I passed him. His voice was serene. Wait inside, my friend. She'll be back. Thank you. Goodbye. Thank you. Goodbye. I walked calmly down the first flight, took the second and two leaps, and sprinted across the village's central plaza. The car was still here, so dusty it looked like a large metal dessert covered in confectioner's sugar. The driver was gone. Wherever he'd went, he'd locked the vehicle's doors before going. I pressed my forehead to its sizzling roof, which popped in and out of place beneath the troubled weight of my skull. I stood there trying to decipher what had just happened while listening to my clapping heart. I wondered what was worse, failing to give Omad's wife the money, or in the process of doing so, bringing down upon her head even more strife. I was not going back in there. The man's calm, even voice had stayed with me. Hearing it had been like an anxiety infusion. While traveling, I trusted people. To do so was personally important to me. Travel without trust could only be fraught, painful. Its dimensions were dread itself. But I was not going back in there. I turned from the car to find the driver walking toward me, smiling. Where the hell were you? I yelled. Jesus Christ, leave me out here. The driver stopped, his head drawing back turtlishly. I had been shouting at him in English. He unlocked the car. I was searching for the non-existent backseat safety belt when a police officer tapped on the driver's window with a truncheon and with his fist made a firm, though polite, roll-it-down gesture. The driver obliged, and the two had a conversation in Tajik. I closed my eyes. A moment later, the officer rapped on my window and made an identical roll-it-down gesture. I was not able to do so without the special spanner. As the driver drug for the tool in his glove compartment, the officer rapped my window again, harder. He barked something in Russian. I can't, I called out, also in Russian, crucially forgetting the word for open, thus confusing the nature of my refusal. Open, the officer shouted. I can't open, I shouted back. The driver leaped from the vehicle to open my door for me, and in the excitement, was restrained. While the officer had him locked in a come-along hold, the driver calmly explained why I refused to open my window. The officer chuckled. The driver, stagily rubbing his released arm, joined him and opened my door. I looked at my watch. It was 12:45, and without mirth, joined the officer and the driver beside the car. The officer found it most unusual that I carried with me no baggage. In Uzbek, I gave him my line. He nodded and asked me the name of my friend's mother. Providing him with the real name of Ahmad's wife was, of course, not possible. That impossibility punched a hole in my mind. I stood there. All of the names of the Russian and Uzbek women and men that I had ever met and could now conceivably use, sinking one by one into a mental bog. Anna, I told him. By doing so, I had locked myself into conjuring up a Russian family name. Uzbek women did not usually have first names, such as Anna. So, Anna what? Do not say Karenina, I told myself. But the only Russian surnames I was suddenly able to convene came from well-known literature. Karamazov, Svidrigailov, Zhivago, Chichikov. Anna Rusanova. This came from Pavel Rusanov, the hero of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's Cancer Ward, one of the few great Russian novels that lacked anything approaching a household protagonist. He repeated her name, and I repeated it, pleased with its sound. Anna Rusanova. She was 70. She dyed her hair red. She wore bifocals. She hated cats. She lived on the third floor with her husband, who was free and who loved her. Where's your gift? The officer asked. My gift. Your gift. You have no bag. Where is your gift? Here it took effort to keep from employing the phoneme stall of, which in Uzbek unfortunately means vagina. My gift is money, I told the officer. I always carried a few sacrificial 20s in my wallet, and I resigned myself to their martyrdom here. Ah, the officer said with a smile, I think I would like such a gift myself. He then asked me where I was staying. I told him. He asked for proof of that. I gave it to him. He asked for my papers. I handed them over. He studied my accreditation card with an expression so thorough in its incomprehension, it seemed profound. He read aloud its formal Uzbek phrasings, then opened my passport as though expecting to find in it some pearl of revelation. With disappointment, he handed both back to me. Are you something? He asked abruptly. His nostrils were wet around the rims. Although we were speaking Uzbek, this unfamiliar word was Russian. I'm sorry, I said. I didn't understand. Something. I realized, unhelpfully, that it was two words. I'm sorry, something, something. Something, something. Something, something, the driver pleaded. Do you understand? I looked to one man, the other. The officer's wet nostril rims shone. The Russian word for nostril was nazdria. Why did I know that and not these words? What, for that matter, was I doing here? Why had I not allowed Rustam to come with me? Why was I not brave or resourceful enough to get Omad's wife her money? The questions ticked away within me while I stood there, my own silence sickening. Something, something, the officer tried again. Yes? Are you something, something? I don't know, I snapped at him. I don't understand. Do you understand that I don't understand? After a few more purposeless questions, the officer let us go. I rode shotgun back to the hotel with my head between my knees, breathing. The driver kept glancing over at me, an odometer of worry. I sounded in my mind the unknown words over and over again in order to keep from forgetting them. We found Rustam where he promised he would be, outside the hotel, draped with our baggage and holding a bottle of Coca-Cola for me. The flat soda tasted hot and caramelized, but I drank it down to an inch below its wraparound sticker. Rustam watched me, chewing his lip. The moment I lowered the bottle, I realized I'd forgotten the words. The driver, luckily, had not. As he told the story, Rustam shook his head, covered his mouth, and began laughing. Above his fingers, his eyes were as narrow and moist as those of a delighted guru. Dude, the militia thought you were a Jehovah's Witness. I took a single step backward, then sat down on the curb. Of course he did. Why wouldn't he? That seems like a completely reasonable conclusion. Look at me. Don't I look like a Jehovah's Witness to you? I was shouting. Where does this stuff come from? These people should be studied. It's uncanny. Jehovah's Witness? Why not an Egyptologist? Why not a Shriner or a Jedi fucking Knight? Rustam towed the sidewalk's concrete. Sorry, I laugh, bro. Getting stopped by the militia is no fun. I know that. Today the sun was sparkling upon the dome of a nearby tomb. I calmed myself down by watching the dome flash and wink. In a few minutes we would leave Samarkand, and I had little idea if I would ever be back. I felt a nudge of melancholy, the quiet inner recognition that the velocity of farewell had become unstoppable. Such sadness I associated with airports and hotel rooms. It was disconcerting to feel it outdoors. My head dipped forward and hung off my shoulders. I didn't get her the money. Rustam sat down on the curb next to me. What happened? I don't want to talk about it. Are you going to go back, bro? I shook. My head hung lower. I shook it. You tried, dude. Thanks. I would love to answer any questions that anyone has, if, in fact, anyone has them. Yes, that is my brother asking me the question. Come on, people, don't let my brother ask me a question. Yes. The money, I returned it to the Committee to Protect Journalists, who was very irritated with me, and who recently wrote me an even more irritated letter about my mentioning all this in the book at all. So. Do you have another question, John? No. Weirdly, I became so genuinely angry because of their questioning. You know, was I a Jehovah's Witness? That he just kind of let us go. I think he may have thought I was crazy or something. So he, there's a question here that yes, sir.
I'm wondering if many of your adventures were just from getting lost.
Yeah. well, when I travel, I tend not to have any plan at all. I just like to go. Sometimes it's great, and this, it was great. I did a piece for Harper's in which I went to the Arctic for a month, and I had no plan. Don't go to the Arctic for a month with no plan. You'll just sit in the hotel and watch Canadian TV for 3 weeks, and it's not, getting lost in a new place is really, I don't like flying, for instance, I find very unnerving still, but actually being in a new place, a new city, having this whole new place to explore, that's my idea of perfect happiness. I really like that. Yes?
When did you start to gain the feel of enjoying an adventure? After the fact, you know, when probably all that helped you or whatever?
No, it was, after I quit the Peace Corps, I moved to New York City, which, considering what I'd just gone through in Uzbekistan, was a snap, you know? And I lived in New York for a few years, and I just got older and more mature, and I realized that you know, new adventures and stuff like that was sort of the point of life, or at least my life, and I really like that stuff now. So yeah, it's during it, and then of course the writing of it is sometimes that's really great too. Yes, sir.
How long did it
take? Well, you know, the actual physical writing of it took about 7 months, but I read for a long time before that. I researched it for about a year, and I read a lot of books and talked to a lot of people. But the actual writing of it, I wrote very quickly. I was lucky enough that I was able to survive in the advance that I was paid for it, so I didn't have to really work. All I had to do was write the book. So I was really lucky. Had I not had that ability, it could have taken me, you know, years. But I was able to work on it and only it. Yeah, I did. The trip that this book covers is really only like a 2-week trip, but I went back twice when I was writing it and once after I finished it, and then did another rewrite after I got back from that trip that I'd finished it. So even though those other trips aren't in the book, they sort of are, you know? They're sort of enriched by the trips that I don't even write about because it was necessary to go back and just see stuff again, talk to people again. Yeah. Yeah, if there's one over here, yeah.
Other than, obviously, Uzbekistan and the Arctic, where else have you traveled to?
Well, I've been to Central Asia several times. I've been to the Arctic twice. That's it. the Arctic and Central Asia is really my sum. There are two kinds of travelers, I've been told. They're the kinds of people who go to a lot of different places once, and they're the kinds of people who go to the same places over and over again. And there are benefits you get from both kinds of traveling, but for whatever reason, I seem to be the latter kind of a traveler. Yeah, I'm going to Vietnam next month, and I'm going to write about that. So, yeah, there's one and back, I think. No, yes, sir.
You said that you know, in this example you just read was how you got mistaken for a Jehovah's
Witness. Yeah.
Before you've been thinking about
it was a very scary legitimately and truthfully frightening thing was, for whatever reason, we were pulled over on a highway, and the guards got it into their head that we were heroin smugglers, and they ripped our car apart, and they strip-searched Rustam, and I was punched in the face. It was a very alarming experience, and I would read that part. Sometimes I read that part, but you got the money part. Some people get the heroin part. Some people get the Jehovah's Witness part. I strongly encourage you to read and buy the book, or to get both. Yeah, they do. They sure do. I'm pretty sure I'll probably never get a visa to go back again, which actually breaks my heart, because Uzbekistan is my favorite place in the world, really. And I'm hoping that I have a friend at the consulate, a guy that I know who's sort of friendly to me, and he has the book, and I sort of called to check to see what the situation was, and he was like, you know, he's like, oh, you know, it's not good. So I'm assuming that, they're not happy about it. But I wrote a piece for Harper's about the Aral Sea disaster, which I happen to know that the Uzbek ambassador to America really liked, because it was, you know, sympathetic. And I am very sympathetic to the Uzbeks, but to the Uzbek government, I'm not so sympathetic. Maybe if they stopped torturing their people, you know, I'd be more sympathetic. But until that happens, I'm happily their enemy. Yeah. So, yes. I'm the. Yes. I was an English teacher in a city called Gulistan, which is a small regional capital in the middle of the country. And I lasted 7 months. And I quit, and it was really a bad time for me. I just couldn't handle it. I went from Escanaba, Michigan, to East Lansing, Michigan, to Uzbekistan, and that sort of trans-dimensional leap was just too much. I just couldn't deal with it, and I came back. I felt like a real failure, and part of the reason I loved writing this book so much was that it was a real exorcism of that failure. So it's begun. You know, I hope it'll probably be a lifetime of fascination with Central Asia, particularly, which is, I just think it's an amazing part of the world. Yeah, I lived with an Uzbek family who didn't speak anything but Uzbek and Russian. So it was either learn how to say, your food is giving me diarrhea, or, which I still know how to say, or suffer the consequences, yeah. So I think we'll take one more. Phil, yeah.
How did you come to decide Vietnam would be the next destination?
Well, I've been asked if I had this publisher, who's a wonderful publisher, and I can't recommend them enough, Pantheon, what I wanted to do next. I wanted to write another travel book, and I suggested to do a book on the Arctic. And so I made my first trip this summer, and as I said, it was a real rough trip. And I realized that I didn't really have enough to say about it, because I didn't have this like emotional kind of connection to it. My interest in the Arctic was just very academic, you know. It was the idea of the Arctic I found interesting. So I wrote a magazine story about it, but I don't have enough for a book. But then I started thinking about my father, and maybe I should lie down here and we should talk about it that way. I started thinking about my dad, and he's a Vietnam vet, and I realized that maybe another travel book could be written about a father and a son going to Vietnam, and just kind of what happens to, I need a sidekick, apparently. I can't write a book without a sidekick, but that's where the Vietnam idea comes from, and I'm actually really excited about it, and it will be a travel book, but one that'll have a real big, I hope, real big beating heart in it. So that's the key for me. I really am very grateful to all of you for coming out. It's wonderful to see so many friendly and faces. And thank you immensely for coming. And Professor McClintock's house. I say we trash the joint tonight.